Well, if you lived in Europe in the early 1800s, you would have been impressed and you would have been terrified at the sweeping movement of a man who nearly conquered the world. His name was Napoleon. He was destined for military genius early on. In fact, at the age of 10, his parents put him in a military academy. And he quickly rose in prominence. When he was awarded the role of Brigadier General, he was only 28 years of age. His first campaign would take place where he would attempt to win control over Egypt. Fast forward a decade or so, and in the waning years of the French Revolution, through masterful intrigue and manipulation, Napoleon is elected to the throne of France, and he has himself named emperor for life. Not long after that, his army battled the Russians and defeated them in a battle that kind of solidified his reputation as a military genius. Tragically, as the retreating Russian troops were fleeing across a frozen lake, Napoleon ordered his troops to pummel the ice with his artillery. His cruel plan succeeded. The ice broke. The retreating Russians drowned, thus solidifying his reputation as a man to be feared. Napoleon saw himself as taking the place of Julius Caesar and Alexander the Great, succeeding where they had failed. And frankly, Napoleon was on everyone's mind. He was in everybody's conversation. He was the man of the hour. He was what mattered most. Frank Borham, one of Australia's best-known authors, wrote these interesting words 100 years after Napoleon's death. He wrote, "If you were living in the year 1809, what mattered most were the battles of Napoleon. 1809 stood midway between two great battles that seemed to shape the destiny of the world. They were the battles of Trafalgar and Waterloo. One battle destroyed Napoleon's naval power, the other battle destroyed his remaining military power. In the year 1809, everyone was thinking of battles. No one was thinking of babies. What was God really planning? In 1809, William Gladstone was born, one of Great Britain's greatest prime ministers. Alfred Tennyson was born that same year, as was Oliver Wendell Holmes in Massachusetts and Frederick Chopin in Warsaw and Felix Mendelssohn in Hamburg. And that same year, 1809, to poor pioneers living in Hardin County, Kentucky, their first baby boy was born into their Lincoln family, whom they named Abraham." Borham concludes this, "Viewing 1809 in the truer perspective of history, which the years enable us to command, we may well ask ourselves if the battles mattered more than the babies who were born in that same year. If you traveled back to Egypt, where Napoleon took his first military command, and then you turned the dial back a few thousand years, the person who mattered most would be this arrogant, cruel warrior, newly crowned Pharaoh, who was commanding a vast empire. For nearly 350 years, he had been helped. He had enjoyed the benefits of free labor, a race of people subjugated into cruel slavery. He had inherited them from his forefathers. Ask anybody in the world, and they would tell you who mattered most, and they would be able to tell you who mattered least, who didn't matter at all. And I'll tell you who certainly wouldn't have mattered and what would not have mattered at all. It would be the fact that in a slave hut near the banks of the Nile, a woman would give birth to a baby boy. A woman whose name many of us may not remember, but she actually mattered most. Her name is Jochebed, and I introduce this text to you for our exploration. Would you turn to the book of Exodus? Exodus is basically a biography of her famous son, Moses. Everybody knows about him. In fact, it hit me today. It occurred to me that there's a movie out right now about him, I think. I'm not sure if it reflects anything biblical or not, but this had nothing to do in its timing with Hollywood. I don't usually determine my calendar by that. In this series of sermons I've entitled Forgotten Lives, Remembered Truths, I want to take a look at a woman who's overshadowed by the events of her world, and in fact, she's overpowered by the circumstances of her life. She's completely helpless, yet she is completely dependent upon God, and that will change the history of the world as we know it. The truth of the matter is Moses would have never been introduced or known, or let alone be alive, if it were not for her courage along with her husband. However, the focus of Scripture tends to point toward her. More than likely, he is away doing hard labor. Now, by the time you get to the end of chapter 1, and many of you who are old enough in the faith probably have read this, and you know, so I'll just quickly touch down. Pharaoh is terrified that the Jewish people are multiplying faster than rabbits, certainly faster than the Egyptians. So chapter 1 ends with this rather cruel edict. Look at verse 22. Then Pharaoh commanded all his people, that is the entire empire, saying, every son who is born you are to cast into the Nile. This is the son among the Hebrews, by the way. And every daughter you are to keep alive. Now, before we dive into perhaps what we know and try to pull some things out that we may have missed, there's a larger context to understand here that I think we do miss. What you've just read is one of Satan's earliest attempts to void the prophetic promise of God in a number of ways, certainly the promise of a coming Messiah. He's going to eventually, or at least here, try to stamp out the Hebrews. He's going to short-circuit the prophecy of a coming Messiah who will come from the Hebrew people. So this is Satan behind the scenes manipulating this. Now, Satan doesn't know the future any more than we do, other than what the Bible has revealed. But you can be certain that he is a careful student of Scripture, especially prophecy. And there's a prophecy that we miss in this that's actually about to come to pass. It's a prophecy delivered by God to Abraham, if you went back, and we won't for the sake of time. But you might write into the margin, right next to verse 22 in Exodus chapter 1, the reference, Genesis 15, verse 13. That prophecy tells us, God delivers to Abraham the news that this people that will come from him will be enslaved for four generations, about 400 years, a little more. But then they will be released from their slavery and they will come out prospering. So Satan has his calculator out and he knows that it's going to be in the next few years, more than likely, that a baby boy who will lead the people out is going to be born. It'll be the fourth generation. Moses is the fourth generation. In fact, these babies born in Egypt around this time represent the fourth generation. 350 years have gone by, and Satan's alarm clock is ringing. So you need to understand that behind this edict is a bigger picture. There is the prince of darkness. There's more than the paranoia and the cruelty and the greed of Pharaoh. You have the prince of darkness manipulating, suggesting, impressing, leading this emperor and his counselors to make a decree that will effectively bring God's promise to naught and stop this prophecy of a deliverer. All right, now with that in mind, let's go to chapter 2 and verse 1. Now a man from the house of Levi went and married a daughter of Levi, that is, they belonged to the same tribe. And the woman conceived and bore a son. Stop for a moment. Like so much of the narrative in the Bible, the main point is the main point, and you're driven to it quickly, and other points are left out, you find out later. I want to tell you here at this point that you discover a little later, it's actually chapter 6, that Moses isn't the firstborn. This might lead you to believe that or think that. He isn't. There's a 3-year-old boy running around that slave hut by the name of Aaron, and there's a 7-year-old a sister who's going to be a big help to mommy, and her name is Miriam. You know what? I was tempted to just kind of pull over here and explore the implications that the leading characters of the coming Exodus are the same 3 children of the same family, 3 kids of the same family. That's really amazing when you think about it. I'll at least say this, what you can see later on in the lives of these 3 kids is that they will have learned well, no doubt from Jochebed, the oral traditions. They would have learned them so well that it ultimately becomes their belief and faith. They will see, they will learn from the persevering faith of their parents. And what's interesting is none of these 3 kids will ever forget that they are not Egyptians, especially Moses. He'll give up what many scholars believe could have been Pharaoh's throne. All of them will give their lives, even risk their lives, in order to follow the true and living God. I wish we had a little more information how 3 kids from the same family end up leading, as it were, the Exodus. We don't, so we'll stop at that point. Verse 2, and the woman conceived and bore a son. And when she saw that he was beautiful, she hid him. You know, as I read that, I thought, what mother doesn't think her newborn son isn't beautiful? I mean, what mother would say, he's ugly, I'm going to throw him away? Well, no, that doesn't happen. A mother in a delivery room would say the same thing. Isn't he handsome? Then they bring him to church and show him to you. And what do? No, you gulp. All the women went, oh. And then they bring him to me. And I do what J. Vernon McGee did. I look down and I go, well, isn't that a baby? And just move on with it. Jochebed delivers actually another son. Now you have this edict that all male babies are to be thrown into the Nile, which means that when Aaron was born, the edict hadn't been delivered. Pharaoh wants to slow down the population explosion, lest the Hebrews mount an army. The larger picture is Satan wants to overturn the prophecy of God. But for Pharaoh, he delivers this edict, which, by the way, would have been incredibly politically clever. Babies were offered to the Nile on a regular basis. This was not new. In fact, the crocodiles, who were considered by the Egyptians to be the servants of the Nile god, gladly received these offerings on his behalf. The Nile was considered to be the source of everything good, everything living. And the highest honor an Egyptian could deliver to his Nile god would be to deliver to him one of their own children, as horrific as it sounds. More than likely, then, Pharaoh is issuing this decree, and it probably sounds something like this. Not this cruel, you know, throw away all those Hebrew baby boys. He was more clever than that. It was probably delivered sort of like this. You know, it's about time those Hebrew people stopped ignoring our gracious God and began offering him tribute, like the rest of us. And everyone in the empire would have cheered. That's a brilliant idea. Let's do it. When this baby boy is born to these slave parents, We know now what should have been a time of celebration is a time of desperation. Now we're told that he's beautiful. Every mother thinks their son is. Dads aren't sure, but mothers are. We're given a little hint at what this means in Stephen's sermon in Acts 7, and for the sake of time, I'll just tell you that you can loosely translate this, that he was no ordinary child. In fact, Stephen adds this interesting phrase, at his birth, Moses was lovely unto the Lord. So we obviously don't have all of the story here, but something supernatural happened. Something revelatory occurred to tell Jochebed this boy is unique to God in a special sense, marked out for God. In fact, Josephus, the first century Jewish historian, passes along a tradition that a dream from God was given to Amram that Moses would become the deliverer. Now, we can't be sure because we're just not told, but what we do know is that these Hebrew slaves had their calculators out as well. They knew the prophecy. In fact, among these slave huts with the newborn cries of every boy for the last 20 or 30 years, there was the hope that maybe he would be the deliverer and fulfill the Abrahamic promise in this regard. So they've been keeping their eye on the calendar too. But in this case, God somehow, in some way, we're not told, revealed to them, and particularly, by the way, the text tells us, to Jochebed. Again, Amram's probably not even there. She receives some sort of sign that this child has a special destiny before God. He is lovely unto God. And so it says here, did you notice? So she hid him. She hid him. When Amram came home, she no doubt told him what had happened, whatever this revelation was. They marveled, no doubt, and conspired to hide him. Now the problem here is that we pass over this too quickly, and I think miss what was taking place. There is no basement in this hut. There is no attic. There is no back bedroom. These Hebrew slaves were so crammed together in their living quarters that nothing was a secret, certainly not the birth of a newborn baby. Everybody knew. Everybody knew. You couldn't hide that fact. The phrase, she hid him, is repeated again in the book of Hebrews in chapter 11 and verse 23. And there it helps us again because it uses a different verb that simply means they concealed. They concealed. The verb is used, and I went to some of my linguist friends like Gerhard Kittel to try to explore this verb and wasn't surprised to find out that my suspicion was correct, that this verb is also used in a secretive context for keeping something hidden from others. You could actually translate it to cover. What's really happening here? They can't hide the fact that they have a newborn baby, but they can keep its identity concealed, covered up. Yes, they obviously have a newborn, but notice they're not throwing him into the Nile, so it must be a girl. And isn't she lovely? Sounds like a song for just a moment there. By the way, when you see a newborn, you don't know if it's a baby girl or a baby boy, do you? I have put my foot in my mouth way too often as a pastor in guessing. And so the clue is to pick up on, at least in our culture, their clothing. If it's pink, it's a girl. If it's blue, it's a Carolina fan. Is that tragic or what, huh? You know, it's a boy. Now, as the baby grows, it isn't long before you don't need the clothing to tell it's a boy or a girl. Evidently, then, for 3 months, Jochebed is living, frankly, every moment of every day with the tension of being found out. So for 90 days or thereabouts, she's nursing him privately. She's guarding any eyes of neighbors. As she keeps him, she's making sure no one's around when she bathes him, when she changes him. We're not told, but we have every reason to believe they followed the law of God. That seems they are very committed to the law of God, so they would have circumcised him according to the law on the eighth day of following his birth, without, of course, in this occasion, any witnesses, any celebration. Probably did it themselves without the help of a rabbi, and they prayed, no doubt, fervently that he would heal without any complications. I tried to imagine what it must have been like for Jochebed and Amram with the family. They're from a tribe. They're related to many people. I mean, the family just kind of comes over, whether you want them to or not, right? They're there. They're talking. They're excited. They want to know. I can tell you as a grandparent, oh, man, that's great. Marcia and I have had so much fun at these reveal parties where our kids tell us what the sexual identity of that baby is going to be. It's been so much fun. Seth and Megan now are expecting their first. It's a boy. I was wrong. I was sure. I was just certain it was a girl. They're having a boy. They haven't decided on a name yet. I've suggested Stephen. Not really. Caroline and Benjamin have had a son now. It's hard to believe, a year and a half old, Nicholas. I can remember the day he was born. I mean, we're all there. Not in the delivery room, but we're in the waiting room, and finally we're allowed to go in, and we all hover around, and it's, look at him. Look at him. Oh, he's got his daddy's chin. He's got his mother's eyes. He looks like his grandfather. He's bald. That's the only thing I had going for me, okay? I mean, you're all talking about it. But imagine now, take that very normal, natural scene, transferred back to this hut. The family's gathered around, and if you knew then what you know now, you would have noticed that Jochebed is strangely quiet, aloof. Maybe she's just tired. I wonder if over time people noticed how she would change the subject when it focused on her baby. It'd be so easy to slip and say him rather than her. And if you've noticed it, there is no name given to him for 3 months. I don't know what the customs would have been among the slaves in Egypt, but if they were like ours today, she would have dressed him in pink. Can you add to that the horror, if you can imagine it, of Jochebed and Amram grieving with other families as their newborn sons are ripped from their arms and thrown into the Nile? We don't know if neighbors have become suspicious. All we're told is at the end of 3 months, they can't hide him. They can't conceal this. We don't know why. Did little Aaron blurt it out to a cousin? Did Miriam tell a friend, a neighbor? We're not told. But we're just informed in verse 3 that she can't conceal his identity is the idea any longer. But listen, don't think for a moment they haven't been planning. They have been planning what to do. Let me show you. Verse 3, when she could hide him no longer, she got him a wicker basket that's made out of interwoven papyrus stalks and covered it with tar and pitch. Tar would have kept the vessel waterproof, pitch was a substance made from a plant that the Egyptians had discovered much earlier that would repel crocodiles. Now notice verse 3 again. She put the child into it and set it among the reeds by the bank of the Nile, and his sister stood at a distance to find out what would happen to him. And the daughter of Pharaoh came down to bathe at the Nile with her maidens walking alongside the Nile. And she saw the basket among the reeds and sent her maid, and she brought it to her. Now, if there's a phrase to underscore, it's this phrase, she set it among the reeds. And there goes a mother now to set her baby among the reeds. Well, this is much more than a coincidence, beloved. She's chosen this place. She didn't just, you know, get the basket out and push it out into the current and say, well, you know, I've done everything I can do. God, it's all up to you now. Well, perhaps that may have been her only option, but hardly. What you have here is a well-thought-out plan. She's been thinking over it for months. While she is going to leave the ultimate result to God, because God's going to have to do some things that only God can do, she is going to do everything she possibly can. And she knows that at a certain time, at a certain place, this princess is going to come and bathe. And Jochebed has the basket placed in the reeds at that very spot. Now, for centuries, this particular daughter of Pharaoh, unnamed here in the text, has been known and passed along from one Jewish generation after another with several different names, two primary names, Thermusa and Bithia. Many believe her name was changed a little later on from Thermusa to Bithia. What you need to understand, at least at this point, I'll say more about her in a moment, is that Bithia is not coming to the Nile with a washcloth and dove soap to take a bath because it's Saturday night. That's not what she's doing here. Isn't that kind of bath like we'd think of a bath? In fact, the only people in this culture that bathed in the Nile to be clean were slaves. She lived in the palace. She didn't have to come to the Nile anyway to take a bath. She lived in incredible opulence and advancement, technological advancement unknown to most of her empire. We now know through excavations that ancient Egyptians at this point in time had already engineered indoor plumbing systems and lavatories that flushed and drained through underground piping systems. The princess would have had her own marble-encased bathroom, custom made with everything she needed and in total privacy. So why is she coming down to the Nile, this muddy banked river, and she has her attendants walking along watching out for wildlife? Why? Because this isn't a bath. This is a ceremonial bathing. This is a ritualistic, superstitious, religiously motivated ceremonial bath. The Egyptians believed that the waters of the Nile were spiritually infused and tied to their god. They believed the waters of the Nile had power to heal and to give long life. And if you think, well, that's so old-fashioned, oh, there are cultures around our world today that have given supernatural properties to water. I have watched with my own eyes people bathing in the filthy water of the Ganges in India, believing that that had miraculous spiritual power. The Egyptians believed that if the Nile god was treated with proper respect and honor, and here's the point, that he could even produce fertility. and life. From what we can piece together, and I'm giving you the summation of a lot of study, she is either a single adult at this point, but more believe she is married and childless. We do know that she will have children later by someone else I'll introduce you to. But we have every reason to believe that she is married and she wants a child, and so she is following the Egyptian superstitions that bring her down to the Nile, as was her custom, to the same location, hoping and longing and wishing for a baby of her own. Don't think for a moment that Jochebed doesn't know this. She set the basket among the reeds at the very spot where Bithiah, the princess of Pharaoh, will arrive with longing in her heart. Maybe the God of the Nile will answer me. Verse 5. She saw the basket among the reeds and sent her maid, and she brought it to her. And when she opened it, she saw the child, and behold, the boy was crying. Evidently, the basket had a lid on it. She opens the lid. Behold, biblical way of saying, look, a boy inside, and the baby is crying. I don't think this was the kind of piercing, irritating, screaming, 4 o'clock in the morning kind of crying where a mother wishes for a Nile River nearby. This is not that kind of crying, I think. I think this is sort of a pitiful whimpering. This is the whimper of an infant who's fearful, perhaps tears playing at the corners of his eyes. The sad, pitiful cry that makes you feel sorry for it. My daughter's mastered it. Worked for me, didn't work on their mother. Of all the things Jochebed could plan for, by the way, she cannot plan this part. Miriam is waiting nearby, the next few verses tell us, and has placed this at just the right spot. She's planned at least this much. Miriam has a line memorized. Moses is in the basket at the right spot at the right time. I have no doubt that when she opened the lid, Moses is a little baby boy is wearing his cutest outfit ever. Little wolf pack on the side of his pajamas. See, after all, the narrative isn't really how clever she is. She is clever, but it's really God at work using her planning and her clever thought and honoring her faithfulness. What you have here, at the moment this lid is lifted, a baby crying, perhaps he's blinded by the sudden sunlight, we don't know. Somewhat fearful with his surroundings. And you watch, notice, and she had pity on him and said, this is one of the Hebrews' children. You've got to be kidding. Those two statements don't belong in the same sentence. This is one of the Hebrews' children, and she had pity on him. It should be, this is one of the Hebrews' children, let's throw him in the Nile. This is one of the Hebrews' children, and she had pity on him. This is treasonous. Oh, this is God determined, God ordained, God provoked pity, where you have Jochebed planning everything she can plan, but at this moment, she opens the lid, and the baby cries, and you have in the heart of the only one probably in the entire kingdom who can make her daddy Pharaoh come up with an exception to the edict, see this baby, and God joins the crying of a baby with the longing of her heart, and there is pity. This is God at work. I don't put Josephus, by the way, as I quote him, tantamount or equal to Scripture, but it's interesting to me that he interrupts in his commentary on the text at this point and writes that what happened next was the princess took Moses, or the baby, and takes him around to her servant girls, her attendants. Those are code words for basically Hebrew slaves. She's looking for a wet nurse. Can any of you nurse him? And she strikes out. It's at this point that Miriam steps forward and delivers her line, verse 7. Then his sister said to Pharaoh's daughter, "Shall I go and call a nurse, a wet nurse, that is, that she may nurse the child for you?" Again, don't read this and think for a moment that this little 8-year-old girl has somehow ingeniously come up with, on the spot, a plan that will allow her mother to nurse the baby. These lines are well rehearsed. They don't know if this will happen, but if it does, we'll be ready. These lines are planned. Imagine your 8-year-old daughter on the stage in a play, and she has the critical line, you know, that the whole play either collapses or combines to reach its appointed end. You'd be out in the audience holding your breath. In fact, you would probably be mouthing the lines because you've worked on them with her and you know them as well as she does. And I hope she says it right. Miriam, I have no doubt this kind of conversation took place. Wait until the princess lets her intention be known that she won't throw the baby in the Nile, but she'll keep it. And Miriam, what she's going to do is she's going to pause because she knows she needs someone to nurse it. And if she pauses long enough, at that moment, you step forward and you deliver your line. "Shall I go and call a nurse that she may nurse the child for you?" Now say it again, Miriam. Prepared, but totally dependent on God to do what only God can do. The lesson here is to prepare, to plan, to do our best, to think things through, and depend on God for the final word. By the way, I think there's something else that could be true. It might not be, but I believe it occurred. Do you think for a moment that this princess didn't see through Miriam's sudden appearance and line? "Shall I go and call a nurse for you who will nurse the baby?" The 8-year-old girl. I think that one word from her in the text, "go," indicated she knew. She knew that she knew. That she knew. That she knew. These women had it figured out. It didn't take much. God had moved in her heart, and she determined for no sane, justifiable, reasonable intention that she is going to adopt this baby as her own son. And in the meantime, she's going to give him back to his mother to nurse and raise him. In fact, scholars are varied in how old he will be when he is given back to the court. He may have been as old as 12 years old, but he had learned well from Jochebed who he was. Now, before we finish, and the alarm clock is about to go off here too, let me show you something that gets lost in the narrative as we wrap this study up of this remarkable woman. Jewish traditions have kept the story of this other remarkable woman, this princess, who also was very courageous, alive and passed it along, honoring her for her compassion and her courage. Her given name, many believe, as I mentioned, was Thermusa, but later changed to Bithia for a reason. Bithia means daughter of Jehovah. That's the same kind of thing that her adopted son is going to say as he takes his stand and he rejects Egypt for the coming promise of the Messiah. study all of its own in Hebrews chapter 11. Even though we're told he was trained, Stephen will tell us that in Acts chapter 7, verse 22, in all of the learning of the Egyptians. Think of this pressure. He will be trained in their university system, engineering, mathematics, astronomy. They were so skilled, they had a very accurate calendar. Their engineers were so proficient, we still marvel at the things they built. They're still somewhat of a mystery. So complex, they defy our imagination. But Moses, after even all of that, never forgot who he was. He learned that in a slave hut at the knee of a slave woman who had risked everything to bring him and keep him alive. This princess is no doubt influenced by Moses. And after some 30 plus years, she chooses to belong to God as well. I doubt that's in the movie. If you see it, let me know. In the first book of Chronicles, at chapter 4, it records the lineage of the Hebrews coming out of Egypt at the Exodus as Moses led them out. And you might want to turn there if you care to, but it's 1 Chronicles chapter 4 and verse 17 where you are given this stunning revelation. And these are the sons of Bithia, the daughter of Pharaoh, whom Mered took, or married. Mered is a Jewish. He's Hebrew. When the Exodus occurs and the people leave Egypt, guess who is among them? This princess. And she marries a Hebrew man by the name of Mered, and these are the names of her sons. She has two of them, Shammai and Ishba. These are the sons of Bithia, the daughter of Pharaoh, whom Mered took to his wife, or to be his wife. Their names are Shammai and Ishba. That's not all. If you haven't turned, just listen. We're given not only the names of her sons, which is accurate and ordinary and normal in a genealogical record. We're never given the names of women or daughters, only ever so rarely, as in Matthew 1. But in this case, we're given the name of her firstborn, which just so happens to be a baby girl. Verse 17 tells us that she names her daughter Miriam. I love that. Miriam. Maybe in honor of the fact that it was Miriam's scripted lines that introduced her to a faithful mother and father, and a little boy who will grow up and never forget who he was. All of this divinely orchestrated by God to checkmate once again Satan's murderous plans to exterminate the Jewish nation. This Pharaoh won't be the last. Not only divinely orchestrated by God to liberate a nation, but to liberate and redeem a woman, an unlikely woman, a woman who was entirely superstitious and entrenched in her religious system, who would go to the Nile River time after time, hoping for an answer, hoping for a purpose, and God in his grace introduced her not only to a baby, to a redeemer, to a husband, to a new nation, but to the living Lord of creation. And she says, you know what? I'm going to change my name in this Exodus. I am now the daughter of Jehovah. Don't you just love that? You just can't make that up, right? God in his grace. By the way, don't ever underestimate the power of one little line that you might deliver in someone's life. You might think it's not all that great, and it faltered a bit. You didn't have it memorized down just pat. So, don't ever underestimate that. Don't underestimate what God has in store for his children who trust him. Don't underestimate the grace of God to change superstitious, religious, ritualistic, pagan, despairing, hopeless creatures and turning them into forgiven, redeemed, new creations who are added to his people and who will, with us, sing one day what we have sung today of his wonderful, marvelous grace. Amen? All right. God bless you. Have a wonderful week as you follow this trustworthy God.